to introduce to you our very distinguished guest speaker, Professor Richard Drayton, who is currently Rhodes Professor of Imperial History at King's College, London. Besides being a distinguished historian, Richard is also first and foremost a quintessential Commonwealth man, a modern internationalist who is truly at home in the Caribbean, North America, Europe, and Africa. He was born in Guyana, we won't hold that against him, but he grew up in Barbados, where he, High Commissioner Barbados is delighted, where he went to school at Harrison College, one of the really leading and the leading grammar school in the Caribbean. See, oh, only Bobby. Thank you very much. Yes. He left the Caribbean as a Barbados scholar, which means he came top of every exam in Barbados.
Easily done.
Unlike most Barbadian scholars, he didn't come to England, he went to Harvard University. Then he went to Yale, where he wrote his doctoral dissertation on the under the direction of Paul Kennedy and Frank Turner. He also spent 2 years as a graduate student at Baylor, as a Commonwealth Caribbean Rhodes Scholar. And in 1992, he came to Cambridge as a research fellow at St. Catherine's College, moving back to Oxford in 1994 to be the Derby Fellow and Tutor in Modern History at Lincoln College. After 1998, he was Associate Professor of British History at the University of Virginia. And in 2001, he returned to Cambridge as University Lecturer in Imperial and Extra-European History since 1500. He's a Fellow and Director of Studies. He has been at Corpus Christi College. And in 2002, he was awarded the Philip Leverhulme Prize for History. He was also a visiting professor of history at Harvard in spring 2009, before coming to King's as a Rhodes Professor in that same year. It's very interesting that Cecil Rhodes did give scholarships to Jamaica, and latterly the Rhodes Trust gave scholarships to the rest of the Caribbean. Now, his academic interests and publications have covered such topics as how European imperial systems began to link together the human communities around the Atlantic Basin, and ultimately in the Indian Ocean and the Pacific region, into one world society. Its product was modern Europe and its post-colonial diaspora, extensions mainly North America and Australia, and there are still unequal relationships with modern Africa, Asia, and the Americas. Professor Drayton, what we all call him Richard, has written extensively on West Indian slavery and British abolitionism, and he was a member of the Academic Advisory Committee of the Bicentenary of the Abolition of the Slave Trade, established by the British Empire and Commonwealth Museum. He edits many very important journals, including the Cambridge Imperial and Postcolonial Studies series of four Palgrave Macmillan, and he's a member of the editorial board of the Journal of Imperial and Commonwealth History. He's also a fellow of the Royal Historical Society, member of the American Historical Association, and the Association of Caribbean Historians. Richard believes that it is important for historians to communicate with the wider public, and in particular, to speak of where their work in the past has relevance to the present. His extensive knowledge of the development of the ideas which fuel the lust for empire and domination has enabled him to look at the Commonwealth in a clear-headed and, I hope, sympathetic manner. He comes to us today to speak at a time when the old certainties about the Commonwealth, about the value of the Commonwealth, not only to its member states, but to the world at large, are being seriously eroded. And there is now an urgency to bring some fresh ideas of how to rejuvenate this association of 53 disparate countries. I hope that you will agree with me when I express on your behalf the hope that Professor Drayton will leave us with the feeling that there is a future for the organization which we serve, are still serving, and which we love. Richard?
Thank you very much, Patsy. Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, it is a great honor to speak with you today, and in particular to celebrate with you the 50th anniversary of the Commonwealth Secretariat. My theme is the Commonwealth in the 21st century. I speak of the future, but turn first, in the 20 minutes or so I've been given, to the present and the past. Let us begin by admitting an ugly truth about where we are now. Few people today believe in the Commonwealth. For some in the global south, it is a useless relic of empire, if not the instrument of some latter-day neocolonialism. For some in the global north, within which we must include Australia and New Zealand, despite their place on the map, it is the rusty vehicle of a superannuated tiers-mondism of the 1970s, irrelevant to the real drivers of progress in the contemporary world. For the wider public here and in the former colonies, there is something cobwebbed and mildewed about the Commonwealth, fusty and irrelevant, where it is not seen as an excuse for expensive junketing by the politicians of poor nations, and as a comfortable tax-free perch for an elite of technocrats. When I pose the question of the meaning of the Commonwealth to a Caribbean audience, one person quipped that my speech to you today should simply be, what can be said about the Commonwealth other than that the bar is open, thank you for coming. About 70% of the budget of the Commonwealth Secretariat is funded by Britain, Canada, and Australia. But it's a reflection of the declining investment of these powers in the organization that in real terms, this contribution has been squeezed for a long time. These declining material contributions are mirrored by a declining level of representation and participation at the Commonwealth Heads of Governments conferences. This reflects an important shift which we need to be candid about. Since the end of the Cold War, we've seen the quiet reconstitution in international relations of what in practice is an alliance led by the United States together with Britain and the former white dominions, the so-called Anglosphere. Now, I've always been a little bit uncomfortable with this word Anglosphere. I remember when I was at Oxford, somebody making a comment about you people from the new Commonwealth, to which I had to gently remind him that Barbados and Jamaica were speaking English, with or without their consent, for a rather long time before any convicts were sent to New South Wales. The foreign security, military, diplomatic, and economic policies of these five powers are tightly integrated today, and they seek to prosecute a common agenda in and through NATO, the European Union, the WTO, and where possible, the United Nations and the Commonwealth, and almost always an alliance with their most powerful transnational, financial, and corporate entities. This corporate, white Anglosphere, public-private program of cooperation is the real power in the early 21st century world, the rise of China notwithstanding. And for it, the Commonwealth is only one tool and one of only limited value. There are no Pierre Trudeaus or Bob Hawkes prominent in the politics of Canada and Australia seeking to take the side of the global south and who see the Commonwealth as fundamental to national identity and interest. Nor are there British politicians who appear to recognize, as Willy Brandt did in the 1970s, how the best interests of the global north lie in the expansion of health, welfare, and economic and social rights in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, even sometimes at the expense of the power and profit of corporations. On the other hand, ambitious political and business entities in India or South Africa seek out bilateral deals with the global north and with China, and rarely think in terms of entities like the Commonwealth. This retreat of a view that the Commonwealth has a central role to play should not surprise us. It is only part of the collapse of the post-1945 Keynesian welfarist programme, within which nation-states and international organisations were viewed as key instruments for the engineering of development, welfare and cosmopolitan progress, and together with them, international economic growth. The Commonwealth today is an elegant vessel which has been left almost beached by that retreating tide of utopian optimism, its rusting bulk surrounded by meaner small boats pursuing their self-interest. When people write optimistically about the Commonwealth today, it is almost always in the language of instrumentality, pitching the organisation as a space for small states and larger ones to meet and talk. But so many of the conversations which it might shelter, such as those about climate change or trade or democratic governance, already have other more prominent institutional drivers. Under Sir Shridath Ramphal, the Commonwealth was an important player in international affairs, not just because of his vision and leadership, but because of the historical moment he inhabited, in which there was a kind of institutional space for the Commonwealth, quite apart from ideological space, which has now closed. Today, whatever the gifts of His Excellency Kamalesh Sharma, real business is done elsewhere, and the Secretariat and the Heads of Governors' Conferences become at times a little like provincial theatres in which the shows of Broadway and the West End receive an airing. Global policy may be prosecuted there, but it is given its form elsewhere, and usually in private councils. And it will continue to be done so if the current arrangements of international society are simply taken for granted. A real, living, vibrant future for the Commonwealth can only lie in challenging the ground on which global society meets. Instrumentality can take us only so far. We need to do the hard work of asking about values and meaning, and even to cultivate an idea of the Commonwealth as a space for a kind of confrontation with things and powers as they are, in which we seek to drive change in the world, and not simply serve the governments of the day. The Commonwealth must be ambitious or it is dead. What is or should be the meaning of the Commonwealth? What terrain should it occupy? These are the questions we must wrestle with, beginning with a backward glance. The idea of a Commonwealth is an ancient one, with its roots in Roman ideas of that set of shared social and human interests which give legitimacy to state power, and which stand above the private interests of the rich and powerful, and which provide a ground for cosmopolitan reconciliation. The idea of the commonweal, of the republica, of the bien public, of the public good, remains a well of pure water from which we still can drink today. It has been the secret spring underlying all the forms which the Commonwealth has taken since its first surfacing as an idea over a century ago. When Lord Rosebery in 1884 announced that the British Empire is a Commonwealth of Nations, quote unquote, he was animated by a peculiar mixture of political ideologies. In one direction, a language of democracy; in another, a language of domination and right. He spoke on behalf of the Imperial Federation movement, the real fons et origin of the Commonwealth idea, which imagined, as Sir John Seeley projected in his lectures on the expansion of England of the previous year, that maritime Britain would only be able to hold its own in the 20th century world against the emerging continental superpowers, the United States and Russia, through forging a global state based on a democratic convergence of Britain's global diaspora. Those of you who have not read Seeley, I'm sure, will be quite flabbergasted to see the precision with which he predicted what would be the great power blocks of the next century. So the Commonwealth idea begins as an ideology of empire for an age of democratic politics. Of course, for Rosebery and his heirs, certainly into the 1940s, with echoes perhaps into our own time, that convergence was based on a racial kith and kin solidarity. It was a British-led alliance of the masters of the world for whom black and brown peoples were intended to be perpetual hewers of wood and drawers of water, and perpetual students of the forms of democratic governance, who would not be ready for decades or even perhaps centuries for the franchise and for self-government, except at the local level. There was, for Rosebery and his heirs, a providential aura surrounding the Commonwealth. For as Rosebery put it, when we look at the empire, I quote, "Do we not hail in this less the energy and fortune of a race than the supreme direction of the Almighty?" The British Empire, at least for those who looked from within the machine, was an instrument for the propagation of peace, order, religion, freedom, economic efficiency, and ultimately democracy to the world. It looked rather different, of course, from the other direction. We may look at the Commonwealth then as being founded from one perspective on a paradoxical combination of democratic ideology and racism. And yet there was something alive in that original hypocrisy, in that global consciousness forced upon Britain by its experience of imperial power. There was something creative and important. What lies on the face of a mask has an agency independent of what moves behind it. Many who loved the late modern version of the imperial idea did so because, however fraudulently, it provided promise to global cosmopolitan brotherhood of man. The common ground of imperialism and anti-imperialism is this idea of a common terrain of humanity. For the imperial idea was the opiate of the elite. Its projects of round tables, of future commonwealths, all spoke to the dream of a distant horizon of equality. "The British Empire is going to be a democracy," wrote the liberal imperial intellectual C.E.O. in 1915, although, of course, in the medium term, the enlightened few would have to rule. Athenian democracy, with its slaves, the Roman Republic, with its colonies, the Christian empires in the modern era, the dominant powers of international society of our own time, all appeal to an idea of community and rights, which justified and justifies present inequality. It is the work of democrats in every generation to hold elites to their word, and to insist that the idea of international society, of a common ground on which we all meet, be made real. It is through such challenges over the generations that we have given democracy a new meaning. And there is much more work to be done. The secondary foundation of the Commonwealth came about 100 years ago, when during the First World War in the 1920s, the politicians of Australia, Canada, and South Africa insisted exactly in this way, that parity of status with Britain should be a reality and not just a fragrant idea. This is the road which led to the Statute of Westminster in 1931, which affirmed the constitutional equality of Britain and the Dominions, and to the doctrine of the multiplicity of the crowns, under which so many British colonies would achieve independence in the 1960s, through which it was asserted that the king or queen might separately and distinctly be king or queen of the United Kingdom, Australia, or Jamaica. We must also remember that Britain did not drive this particular turn in events. It came from the Dominions, who insisted on separate diplomatic representation in the United States after the First World War, and even in the case of Canada, to a currency linked to the dollar rather than the pound. The third for us, perhaps most important refoundation, came in the late 1940s, in which it was the genius of Nehru to insist that it was possible for the principle of democratic sovereignty to be given its fullest extension in the Commonwealth, for republican government to be its foundation, and for Britain to be a member like any other, no longer to be primus inter pares. He, of course, had those on the other side of the table who met him halfway. 1948 was the year of the Nationality Act, one of the most extraordinary pieces of British legislation, which affirmed, and this lasted for at least a decade, that a child born in Kingston, Jamaica, would be as fully British as a child born in Kingston-on-Thames, or Kingston, Ontario. This particular vision of British nationality was connected to a particular economic and developmental program, in which it was projected in ways which we must take seriously, and not merely as a form of shaded neo-colonial scheming, in which it was projected that within the second half of the 20th century, it would be through some form of cooperative economic development that both the shattered powers of the global north at the end of the Second World War and the new underdeveloped nations of the global south would together make a common prosperity. In many ways, this was the high water mark of a certain kind of Commonwealth idea. And yet, of course, 1948 is a resonant year for other reasons. It is the year in which the apartheid regime emerged in South Africa, and in which we can see also, in the midst of the turning of the Cold War, the emergence of a new set of stratagems which had to do with attempting to secure, through the control of nationalism, the interests of the West in the rest of the world. And really, by the late 1940s, in the midst of the Malayan Emergency, in the midst of the arrest of colonial nationalists in places like the Gold Coast, the shooting of nationalists in British Guyana, the path was set which led inexorably towards what would be the Bandung Conference of 1955, the Suez Crisis of 1956, and the forms which decolonization would take in the late 1950s and in the early 1960s. But if the ghost at the heart of the old Commonwealth which preceded 1945 was the British Empire, we might argue that the ghost at the heart of the new Commonwealth which was being created, of which Nehru should be seen in a sense to be the father, was the spirit of the Bandung Conference, that great meeting which took place 60 years ago this April, which brought together Nehru, Nasser, Nkrumah, with Sukarno, Ho Chi Minh, and Zhou Enlai. It is that Bandung spirit that the international system should be refounded to serve the best interests of the majority of the people in the world. This idea of a set of common global interests in which the poorest and weakest would be equally represented, which inspired Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana, Milton Obote of Uganda, and Eric Williams of Trinidad and Tobago, in the push which led to the foundation of the Commonwealth Secretariat in 1965. And it is to this idea that Trinidad Ramphal proved to be such an exceptional servant. We must remember that, much as in the 1920s, in the 1960s, the reformation of the Commonwealth in the service of an expanded democratic Commonwealth was initially resisted by Britain, joined to some extent by former insiders of the club. And yet, in important ways, putting to one side Margaret Thatcher's discomfort with the organisation, British policymakers came to recognise in the 1960s, 70s and 80s that the post-colonial Commonwealth was an entity through which they could do business, a means of connecting bilateral and multilateral initiatives. And so perhaps it might be in our time. For the programme I shall very briefly outline to you today is one premised on the Commonwealth challenging Britain, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and indeed also India and South Africa, the big dogs of the organisation, to confront the interests and rights of the smaller, poorer, and weaker members of the Commonwealth, and indeed those who lie outside of the political space. It is to that idea of the Commonweal towards which the Commonwealth must return to refresh itself. We need to dare to believe that another and better way of living, both in this society and around the world, is possible. I recognise that the paradox of our neophiliac age is that we are profoundly anti-utopian. Such a contradiction, this age in which we welcome technology, we believe that anything is possible, but we don't no longer believe it's possible for human beings to reorganise their societies in any way other than the way in which it's organised at present. We think that all that's left for us is to manage the spaces left behind by history or by the power of private interests. But we must begin to dream again, and to punctuate perhaps our darkening sky with Chinese lanterns of utopian light, to believe again that human beings can think and work towards a commonweal, a republic, a bien public, which is larger and more important than any nation state or corporate entity, and which should and does have the power to remake the world. We need to ask the big questions about how we live now, and how might we live in 20, 50, or 100 years' time. Might the Commonwealth lead international conversation on some of the more controversial questions of our age? The extraordinary growth of economic inequality, both within and across nations, in the midst of prodigious economic growth. If you look at the relative multipliers of the size of the economies in places like in Africa or in the Caribbean, in the middle of the 20th century or in the early 20th century relative to the economies of the global north, the gap was much closer. We're looking, in other words, not just simply at a kind of emergence of wealth and poverty on an extraordinary scale in terms of private civil society arrangements, but also in terms of the relative economies of nation states in different parts of the world. How do we address this? This seems to me to be a question which there were some interesting reflections on in the 1970s, to which we might productively return. We might also look at the retreat of real democratic popular control of governments in this country and around the world, from many people's perspective, in the midst of expensive elections and entrenched political parties. The gap between, in other words, the delivery of a 4 or 5 year cycle of elections and the perception of citizens that they are fully included is, I think, a growing one. We might look at the same time at the tension between economic underdevelopment and environmental conservation. We cannot talk about climate change without talking about poverty. We might look at the contradiction between free trade being an instrument for some kinds of economic growth and forms of, and on the other hand, that forms of protection, in particular in industries, in fact, have been the essential basis of every historical case of industrialization. The United States, we must remember, from the 1790s until the early 20th century, had a tariff on industrial imports of about close to 40%. That was the umbrella under which its industrialization took place. And similar kinds of challenges to some of the assumptions of the free trade dogma of our age were the basis of economic growth in Western Europe and earlier in the 18th century in Britain itself. Free trade has some uses, but it has its limits, and this needs to be addressed. At the same time, we might want to ask about the right of some nations to make wars unilaterally, while at the same time sealing their frontiers to refugees who are victims of these wars. We might ask about the problem of governments retreating from the delivery of public services at the same time as no private actors are actually entering the space which they once occupied to provide high quality education, healthcare, and public services. Many of the policy solutions which were experimented with in the period from circa 1980 to the present, so-called economic liberalization, privatization, the retreat of government, need to be rethought in the 21st century. For their fruit has been forms of the visible collapse of many forms of human development in the midst of some quite indifferent results for economic growth in many parts of the world. I recommend for your attention an article which you can find with very quick Google called "The Emperor Has No Growth," which compares the rates of economic growth around the world between 1960 and 1980, the heyday of Keynesian economics and of the principle of national sovereignty, forms of multilateral led development programs, with the pattern of economic growth from 1980 to 2000. The period in which we are supposed to have seen this miracle of economic liberalization. And what becomes quickly apparent is that only in those parts of the world which broke the rules of the neoliberal movement, such as China, arguably in some ways India, have we seen, in fact, economic growth, which has in fact been of the same quality or better than the kind of economic growth that existed in the first 20 years of the post-colonial moment. And this, I think, deserves our attention. Can the Commonwealth be a vehicle through which the international system takes stock of itself in the way it cannot within the United Nations? Might the nations of the global north and south begin through its councils to engage in a set of dialogues which genuinely open up the possibility of new directions? One of the key problems of the post-1990 period are the ways in which the global north has been able to set the rules of the international system. We might ask, for example, how might the IMF, the WTO, be reinvented? how might the interests of the private and public sectors of the world be rebalanced in the larger interest of the public? And this conversation needs to be opened up somewhere, and perhaps the Commonwealth is the vehicle for this. There will, I imagine, be for many of you a familiar sound to this. What I'm proposing is nothing less than the Commonwealth leading a reopening of the kinds of questions being asked by Willy Brandt and the protagonists of the idea of a new international economic order in the 1970s. There is, in fact, a new issue of a journal called Humanity, which looks at this program for new economic order, new international economic order, in the context of the emergence of ideas of human rights in the 1970s, which I also would recommend to your attention. It will be argued that Britain, Australia, and Canada would be allergic to such an initiative. And of course they would be. We should expect that. And yet I'm confident that they would stick around and would want to be part of the discussion if it was conducted in a respectful and open but resolute manner. For it's also true that the question of inequality and of the erosion of democracy is one which exercises the citizens of the global north as well as the global south. In many rather curious ways, the forms of offshore wealth extraction, which once characterized the location of the colonies to the mother country, now describes the experience of the British and Australian and Canadian people relative to the 21st century forms of offshore capitalism. Companies which make profits onshore but pay no taxes there. There's plenty of ground to find a new terrain of commonweal, if we dare. In this, the last may be the first, and those nations which emerged most recently from an experience of non-consensual government may yet lead a new moment of democratization in the history of the world. I conclude with the poet Aimé Césaire, for it is not true that the work of being human is complete, but it's left for us simply to sit at the feet of the world. The work of being human is only just beginning. It remains for us to conquer all the interdictions which remain lodged in the recesses of our passions, and no race has the monopoly of beauty, intelligence, or force, and there's room for all at the rendezvous of victory. Except, I might add, the victory is never complete. Each generation has the task of renewing and extending the temple of human rights. Thank you very much.